Hey everyone, welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're tackling a really big one today, especially for all you law students out there.
Yeah, we're going deep on a case that's so crucial to understanding school desegregation law in the U.S. even today.
Exactly. And it might seem like we're going way back in time, but trust me, the case we're diving into, Columbus Board of Education v. Penick, this 1979 decision, it's not just some dusty old legal history.
Oh, absolutely not. It gets right to the heart of how segregation has persisted in schools and what courts can actually do about it, even decades after Brown v. Board of Education.
Okay, so to make sure we're all on the same page, Brown, that's the landmark case that said separate but equal. The idea that you could have separate schools for black and white kids as long as they were supposedly equal in quality, that was out the window. Unconstitutional.
Right, but Brown was just the beginning. Penick comes along much later and grapples with a much harder question. What happens when segregation continues, even without these explicit laws saying, okay, separate schools?
So that's our mission today. We're going to figure out why the Supreme Court decided to uphold a system-wide desegregation order in Columbus, Ohio, way after Brown. What were the legal arguments that made them decide that? And what does this case tell us about how courts understand the idea of intent when it comes to school segregation cases and the Equal Protection Clause?
Because it's one thing when you have a law on the books that clearly segregates, but how do courts deal with less obvious forms of segregation? Where do they draw the line? And that's exactly what we'll be digging into today, using a detailed case brief and some different perspectives that were shared by the hosts of the other podcasts we listened to.
All right, so let's set the scene. This lawsuit kicks off in 1973. That's almost 20 years after Brown, right? Mm-hmm. Parents in Columbus filed this suit. What were their main allegations against the school board? What were they saying the board was doing wrong?
Well, the parents claimed that the Columbus Board of Education was basically intentionally keeping the school system segregated, even though Brown said they couldn't do that. And the district court actually found a lot of specific stuff to back this up. Like, they found that the board was doing things even after 1954 that were basically making segregation worse.
Like what kinds of things?
Well, one example is they kept building new schools in neighborhoods that were already racially segregated. So you can imagine how that just kind of solidified those existing divisions.
Right. So it's not just about where the schools are, but also how kids get assigned to them. The attendance zones, right?
Yeah, exactly. The court found that the way these attendance zones were drawn, it wasn't just about who lived closest to which school. They were sometimes drawn specifically to separate black and white students, even when it would have been totally possible to have more integrated schools based on where people actually lived.
And there was more, right? What about the teachers and principals? How they were assigned to different schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a problem too. The district court found that the board was assigning black teachers and principals mostly to schools that were mainly black and white teachers and principals to mostly white schools. So even though you didn't have a law saying, okay, black teachers can only teach black kids, the way they were assigning staff was still basically keeping things segregated.
And I remember reading something about optional attendance zones. How did those fit into all of this?
So these optional zones were supposed to give parents some choices about where to send their kids. Like in certain situations, they could go to a school outside their assigned area. But what often happened was that white families used these options to send their kids to schools that were mostly white.
So it kind of backfired.
Yeah. And the plaintiffs in the case, they argued that this made the segregation problem even worse in the schools that those white kids would have gone to otherwise. And the court agreed with them.
Okay. So we've got all this evidence that seems to show the board was doing things that were having a segregative effect. What was the board's defense? How did they try to justify all of this?
Their main argument was, look, it's not our fault. The segregation in the schools is just a reflection of how people live. The neighborhoods are segregated, so of course the schools are too.
But they're basically saying their hands were tied.
Right. But that brings us to the big legal question here. The court had to figure out, did the board's actions after Brown, even if they seemed neutral on the surface, did they actually show an intent to keep schools segregated? And if they did, what could the court actually do about it? Could they order this huge system-wide fix, like redrawing the entire district and busing kids to different schools?
So let's talk about what Justice White, who wrote the majority opinion, had to say about all of this. How did the court actually define intent in this case? Because it sounds like it's more complicated than just finding a smoking gun, like a memo where someone explicitly says, we're doing this to keep black and white kids apart.
Right, you hit the nail on the head. Justice White made it very clear that you don't need this blatant, like, I hate integration kind of statement to prove intent. The court said you can actually figure out intent by looking at what the board could have reasonably foreseen. So if they took actions that they knew or should have known would lead to more segregation or even just keep things the same, that could be enough to show intent, even if they didn't come right out and say that was their goal.
Okay, so it's about whether they could have predicted what would happen and whether they turned a blind eye to those consequences.
Exactly. Like, imagine if the board builds a brand new school in an area that's 100% white, and they know, or they really should know, that this is going to make other schools even more segregated. Well, that could be seen as proof of intent, even if they don't say, yep, we're building this school to keep things segregated.
That makes sense. So how did the court actually apply this idea to the facts of the case? What was the specific test they used? Let's break it down for our listeners.
All right, so the court used a four-part test. It's like a checklist. First, they asked, was Columbus running a dual school system, meaning one for black kids and one for white kids, back in 1954 when Brown happened? And the district court had already said, yes, definitely.
Okay, so first question checked off. What about the next part of the test?
Second question, did the board actually try to dismantle that segregated system after Brown said it was illegal? And in this case, the court said, nope, they didn't.
And the third and fourth parts of this test, what were those?
The third question was, okay, did the board do anything after 1954 that actually made segregation worse or kept it going? And here the court said, yeah, they did. And they pointed to all that stuff we talked about before, like messing with the attendance zone boundaries and assigning teachers based on race.
Right. So basically the ways they were running the school system were still contributing to segregation.
Exactly. And then the fourth, and maybe the most important question was, is the segregation that's happening in Columbus right now, is it directly because of the things the board did? And the court's answer, yep.
So because the answer to all four of those questions was basically yes, that's why the court said this big system-wide remedy was needed. Things like redrawing the district lines and busing kids to different schools.
Exactly. The court's reasoning was the board had been doing this for so long, intentionally segregating schools, that they needed a big system-wide solution to fix the problem. It wasn't enough to just tweak a few things here and there.
And this is a really crucial point for everyone listening. The court didn't buy the board's argument that it was all about where people chose to live. They said even if the neighborhoods were already segregated, the board couldn't make it worse than the schools. They had a duty to try to integrate, not make things more separate.
Yeah, the court wasn't blaming the board for residential segregation. That's a whole other issue. But they were saying, look, you can't just use that as an excuse to do nothing. You have a responsibility to actively work towards desegregating the schools, even if it's hard.
It's like they were saying, don't use housing patterns as a shield to avoid your constitutional obligations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know there were some strong disagreements with the majority opinion. What did Justices Rehnquist and Powell have a say in their dissents?
Justice Rehnquist was really focused on this difference between de jure segregation, which is segregation that's written into law, and de facto segregation, which is segregation that happens in practice, often because of things like housing patterns. He thought the majority was blurring the line between those two. And his main point was, you haven't shown enough evidence that the board was intentionally discriminating after 1954, so you can't just go and completely overhaul the whole school system. He thought any fixes should be much more specific, like only target the things they could prove were intentionally discriminatory.
So he was worried about the court going too far, maybe stepping on the toes of local authorities. What about Justice Powell? Did he have similar concerns?
Yeah, Justice Powell was also worried about what he saw as the court overstepping its bounds. He was concerned that if courts started holding school districts responsible for all the segregation in society, they'd basically become school superintendents, which is not their job. He thought that would lead to a lot of resentment and wouldn't actually help achieve integration in the long run.
So he was basically saying courts need to stay in their lane. But there was also a concurrence from Justice Stewart. What was his take on all of this?
Yeah, Justice Stewart agreed with the majority's decision, even if he maybe had some questions about how far-reaching the solution was. His key point was that, unlike another case, the court decided the same day, this one in Dayton, Ohio, in the Columbus case, the plaintiffs had actually done enough to show that intentional segregation happened after 1954. They had made what's called a prima facie case, which means they'd shown enough evidence to shift the burden of proof to the school board. So now it was up to the board to prove they weren't intentionally segregating, and Justice Stewart agreed that they hadn't done that.
Okay, so that lines up with another important case about desegregation, Keys v. School District No. 1, which was about Denver. Mm-hmm. So Justice Stewart was basically saying the lower courts were right to say the board hadn't shown they weren't intentionally segregating.
Exactly.
So let's bring this back to today. Why does this case, which happened back in 1979, why does it still matter so much? I mean, for all of you future lawyers out there, why is Columbus Board of Education v. Panic a case you absolutely need to understand?
Well, Panic is a really big deal because it shows us that courts are going to look beyond just what a school board says. They're going to dig deeper and see what's actually happening, what the real effects of their policies are. It forced school districts, especially those with a history of segregation by law, to really think about how their rules, even ones that seem neutral, could be making things worse.
And even though the specific solutions ordered in Panic, like busing, were really controversial, the core idea behind the decision is still super relevant today.
Oh, definitely. The legal landscape around school desegregation has changed, but Panic reminds us that institutions, like school boards, have a responsibility to actively fight against segregation. It's not enough to just stop doing things that are obviously discriminatory. They have to be proactive and actually try to make schools more integrated.
It really makes you think about a lot of the issues in education today. Like, how do the ideas in Panic apply to things like huge differences in school funding from one district to the next? Or how zoning laws can make housing and therefore schools more segregated?
Yeah, those are great questions. And Panic forces us to wrestle with them. This idea that you can figure out intent from what people could have reasonably foreseen, and this idea that institutions have a responsibility to fix the problems caused by past discrimination. It's not just about busing. It's about any policy that could be keeping things unequal.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into Columbus Board of Education v. Panic, what's the most important thing for our listeners to take away?
The big takeaway is that the Equal Protection Clause demands more than just sitting back and saying, we're not doing anything discriminatory. Especially in places where segregation was enforced by law, there's an obligation to actually integrate schools. And Panic confirmed that intent to segregate can be shown not just by what people say or do directly, but also by whether they ignore the fact that their actions are going to keep schools segregated or even make it worse.
And for all of you studying law, understanding Panic is crucial. It helps us see how complicated it is to come up with solutions to constitutional problems, how the courts balance their power with the power of local authorities, and how much racial segregation still affects American society. It's a case that's still shaping how we think about fairness and equality in education.
Couldn't have said it better myself. And on that note, I want to leave you with a final thought. We know there are still so many debates about equality and opportunity in education. So how well have the legal principles established in cases like Panic actually worked in creating truly integrated and fair school systems? And what else needs to change, legally or in society as a whole, so we can finally achieve the promise of Brown and get rid of even the most subtle forms of segregation that still exist today? That's something I hope you'll all keep thinking about. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
See you next time.